conditioned residuals, for example, as you would for maybe for stopping criteria or whatever, they look like the error in the two norm of the original system. There's no twiddles here. Okay, so this is a nice property. If you're interested in the error, your original system, and you precondition on the left, this automatically comes out of your algorithm. However, if you precondition on the right, so you apply on the other side, then you're actually minimising in the correct norm, because the two norm of the preconditioned residuals is equal to the two norm of the true residual. Okay. If you precondition on the left, this is not true. So if I were to precondition on the left and plot the residuals that come out, the two norm of this residual here, it looks like the error and not the residual. Okay. Whereas if you precondition on the right, the preconditioned residuals and the true residuals are the same. So sometimes when you're looking at convergence plots, you have to bear this in mind. Are they the preconditioned residuals you're looking at, or are they the true residuals? In this case, they're the same. If you've implemented it in this way, they're not the same. Okay, so there are implementation issues to think about. So essentially, once you've got this idea of applying your preconditioner, can be incorporated into any of the algorithms which I've talked about. So the example that I've given here is the PCG method, so preconditioned conjugate gradients for symmetric positive definite problems. Just because we looked at the conjugate gradient algorithm, of course, earlier on, the primary difference is this step here. There's an extra step, solve with the preconditioner as coefficient matrix. So that's where this balance comes in. We have to be able to solve this step pretty cheaply. Okay, so the preconditioner can be incorporated in all of these other algorithms in a similar sort of way. So that's really the sort of idea of it and how to implement it. Of course, the question you want to know the answer is, what is M? What is this magical preconditioner that's going to so improve the convergence of my method that it will whiz through? Well, there's endless possibilities for me now to tell you about preconditioners. I've just picked out a few, again, mostly ones that I have used in the past and therefore know a little bit about, to give you a flavour. You'll hear about other ones this week, and there's lots and lots of literature on the subject in particular fields. So, to start with, the first class, if you like, I'm going to talk about are how preconditioning connects with stationary iterative methods. Okay, so what do I mean by stationary iterative method? I mean something like Jacobi, Gauss-Seidel, SOR, SSOR. Okay, so let me remind you where stationary methods come from, if you like. You start off with a matrix splitting, A equals M minus N, and you set up an iterative method like so, with your splitting matrices, which give you an iteration matrix, M inverse N, in here. Okay. The error of a stationary method satisfies the property. Again, here's the error, the kth iterate minus the exact solution, and we have a polynomial term here, I minus M inverse A to the power k of the initial error. Okay, so this is basic algebra that certainly our students do second year undergraduate, right? Stationary methods. So, what do we see from this? Here's the error in the stationary method. We've talked about this idea that for a preconditioner, we have a good preconditioner if M inverse A looks like the identity. Okay, so in this case, if this thing here is small, we're going to have rapid convergence, because as k increases, this is going to dissipate very rapidly. So you can see already there's a connection, the idea that a good preconditioner is going to give a good splitting operator here in the matrix splitting stationary method. Okay, we're looking for the same property in both cases, in other words. We're looking for this thing to be small. Right, so what if we take our stationary method and we make it slightly more sophisticated by adding an iteration parameter? All right, so the change I've made here is I've inserted this green alpha up here as an iteration parameter, which comes through in the error exactly as you might expect. And then if I take the slightly more sophisticated step of letting alpha vary from iteration to iteration. So instead of just being a fixed alpha, it becomes alpha k, which might be different at each step. Then I can expand this expression to the power k in individual terms. And what do I get? Well, the blue part here containing the alphas is none other than a polynomial of degree k with constant term 1. So where have we seen those before? In conjugate gradients. Right? So if we take a stationary method, we allow it to have a varying iteration parameter, then we're getting precisely conjugate gradient polynomials. Particularly if I don't use preconditioning here, I set m equal I, this is precisely the conjugate gradient method. Okay? So there's an extremely close connection between these splitting methods and preconditioned conjugate gradient method. In other words, any matrix M that comes from a stationary method, splitting, can be used as a preconditioner. Okay, so here are some common matrix splittings. So the Richardson method is basically conjugate gradients because M is equal to I and it gives the conjugate gradient polynomials. Jacobi method, we can use M equals D. So in other words, I can use the diagonal of my matrix as a preconditioner with, again, for example, the conjugate gradient method. Okay. Similarly, Gauss-Seidel, we can use this part of the matrix. SOR, we can use splitting matrix here, or SSOR, the symmetric version, splitting matrix here. So any of these can be used as a preconditioner for conjugate gradients. So how good are they? Well, we've got two things to think about. One, what are they doing to the eigenvalue distribution? And two, how cheap are they to calculate? Okay. So the one I want to highlight here is Jacobi, or diagonal scaling. Right? Because it's not going to have very much effect on the eigenvalues, but you're not going to find much cheaper to solve with the system M U equals R. Right? Something with a diagonal matrix is very cheap to solve. So this is why I keep banging on about this balance between the two. In a lot of practical, enormous 3D simulations, then companies like, for example, Boeing, use diagonal scaling because it's the only thing that's practical enough to solve that preconditioned system. In my PhD thesis, I looked at preconditioners for three-dimensional finite element problems on irregular grids, compared a whole load of fancy preconditioners. The conclusion was diagonal scaling was the best because the number of iterations you could cut down by using all sorts of fancy things, but the actual cost per iteration of the preconditioner was so much that it outweighed diagonal scaling. Okay, so obviously that will not always be the case. Some cases you can do much better than diagonal scaling and it's just not good enough. But bearing in mind this balance, sometimes these stationary methods, very straightforward, can do very well. Mm-hmm. However, they're not always good enough, so let's talk about something a little more sophisticated. And this is just a little taste of what Edmund's going to tell us about this afternoon, right? We have a survey talk on incomplete LU factorizations. So this is a very basic introduction to that topic. This is probably the most common type of preconditioner, I would say, for general problems, and it's very often very efficient. So what is it? Well, basically, it's like an LU factorization of a matrix as normal, except it avoids filling. So what you do is you select, in this example, a set of index pairs in your matrix. Okay, so you say, here are some spaces in my matrix that I'm not going to allow filling. I want my final matrix to have this sparsity pattern. So you choose the sparsity pattern. Then you do the LU factorization as normal, and every time you get something that would be filling, you just chuck it away, throw it into this residual matrix R. Okay, so for example, it's very common to say you won't allow any filling, you'll keep the sparsity pattern of A the same as you go through the factorization. So every time you do your elimination, you get an entry, oh, it would have gone in here, you just chuck it away. Okay. So it means that you don't have LU equals A as you would with a full LU factorization, but you hopefully you have approximation that LU approximately looks like A, so that LU inverse times A will approximately look like the identity. So that's the idea. I've got this parameter alpha in here, which you'll see more of in a moment. The trouble is ILU factorizations do not always exist, so sometimes you just cannot use this method. They're extremely sequential in nature, so on parallel machines they're not always the method of choice. But there are very many variations, and there's a lot of block matrix analogues, which I don't know, we'll certainly hear more from Edmund this afternoon on that. I just wanted to... I'd forgotten I had that in there. That's the trouble with these electronic things. You don't know what's coming next. Yes, it's quite exciting. So, yes, so here's the algorithm of the factorization. And basically, it looks not unlike an ordinary LU factorization, except you're doing a lot of... You do if the index pair is in my sparsity pattern, then I'm doing this. If not, I'm just skipping through. Okay, this is a schematic version of how the algorithm might look. Right, so here's a slide I thought I was getting last time with some variations on ILU factorization. So first of all, there's the one that I mentioned. Suppose you take your sparsity pattern to be the non-zero entries which are already have the same sparsity pattern as A. Then this parameter alpha gives, if you set that to be zero, you get the original ILU by Meyer-Yink and van der Voorst, the kind of vanilla flavour. Gustafsson proposed a modification of this by taking slightly different sums in the residual, which involves taking the parameter alpha equals 1. Other variations on a theme, very briefly, you can change the sparsity pattern by saying maybe, right, well, I'll allow it to expand by two diagonal stripes on each side, the fill-in, in the hope that that will give you a better approximation. And you can do that with MILU also. An alternative to fixing the sparsity pattern is to use what's called a drop tolerance. So then you just do the factorization as normal, but you get, if you get to an entry which you deem to be too small, you choose some parameter tau, and then you just chuck out all the fill-in that's smaller than that limit. Okay, so you say, well, it's so small, we'll just ignore it and throw that away. So that's a different dropping strategy. And then here's an example of shifted ILU, where you can change your matrix, make it more diagonally dominant, because that's LU is better for such a matrix by adding some sort of shift, and so on, and so on. But Edmund will tell us more about this afternoon. I just wanted to show you one picture to give you a flavour of the eigenvalue plots. This is us back at our 7-point finite difference stencil again in the 3D problem. So if you remember, these were fairly evenly spread eigenvalues. This was a symmetric problem, so it's incomplete Cholesky. In fact, it's in a ILU. So with the incomplete Cholesky, this is what the eigenvalues look like. They're certainly much more clustered. And then this is with Gustafsson's modification, modified incomplete Cholesky. So at first glance, it looks like this is bound to be better than this. The crucial thing in terms of finite elements is the fact that the modified incomplete Cholesky is guaranteed to have smallest eigenvalue of 1. Okay, so the eigenvalues are now spreading upwards from 1. And as you refine your finite element grid, then this bounds the eigenvalues away from 0, which is very nice. Remember, our polynomial has to go through the point 0, 1. So if we can keep this point here as far away from 0 as possible, the polynomial is going to have more chance of fitting the eigenvalues. Okay? With incomplete Cholesky, this smallest eigenvalue is still going to 0 like h squared. So as we refine the grid, this is getting closer and closer to 0. So that just gives you a little flavour of how these might look. Now we get into a fairly random selection of other preconditioning methods, which I have met in my career, if you like, I suppose. So one idea which was popular in the past was polynomial preconditioning, which said, right, instead of applying to Ax equals b, we'll apply to this system here, where we choose some polynomial in the matrix B inverse A times B inverse A. So why is that popular? Well, the inverse of our preconditioner here looks like this. So when we try to solve a system mu equals r, we can just apply the action of the inverse to r, and this is easy to do if this is a polynomial. It just becomes multiplication, provided that b is something that's easy to invert. Okay, so to solve my preconditioner system, this has an easy application. So if you choose b to be something easy to invert, this is a nice method. So for example, if you choose b from the SSOR method, you get the what's called the M-step conjugate gradient method. If you choose b just to be the identity, you also get some sort of polynomial preconditioning. Okay. Now this is attractive because it's useful to do in parallel, this sort of preconditioning. But somehow, it's a little bit unsatisfactory to my mind anyway, from the point of view that we've already seen that conjugate gradients is going to construct optimal polynomials in the sense of minimizing the error, and so to try and introduce more polynomials to something which in some sense is already optimal, I'm not sure. I don't know how much success has been had by these things in real life, to be honest. Okay. Right, so again, I come from finite element background, so most of the things I've met are grid-based preconditioner. So here are three examples here. First of all, hierarchical basis preconditioners. This is basically when you have a hierarchy of finite element basis functions. You can set up the transformation matrix from the standard function at each level and construct a preconditioner from this. It has nice properties in two dimension, but Beth Ong in her thesis showed that in fact it's more complicated to implement in three dimensions and has some really prohibitive difficulties there. So it has some advantages for some problems. Multigrid methods, of course, we have entire conferences on multigrid methods by themselves, so we're not even going to go there. But we do have Scott McLaughlin's going to be talking about multigrid methods tomorrow. So again, we will have an expert overview on these things separately. And recently, that's not how you spell algebraic multigrid, but that's what it's supposed to say. Algebraic multigrid has been introduced, meaning multigrid basically that doesn't rely on the underlying PDE structure. Okay. And finally, on this slide, we have domain decomposition techniques. That's where you have your finite element grid, and you might want to precondition each part of the grid with a different preconditioner and somehow combine those. So these, again, can be extremely efficient on parallel computers where you can farm out part of your domain to each processor and precondition it separately, in a sense.
It also has the advantage that you only get a few non-zero eigenvalues. I mean,
for domain decomposition.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and then if the rank of matrix n, let's say, in splitting is low, let's say it's rank p, then it only takes p plus one iterations of conjugate gradient.
Right. Yeah. So that's the theoretical property, I guess, that makes it very attractive. Yeah. That's a good point. Okay. So these are kind of general families. I've just included a couple of extremely specific finite element preconditioners just to show you the sort of thing that people can construct. And for those of you who don't know finite elements, this may not mean a great deal, but basically this particular method, you work with the individual element matrices, you assemble up your individual element matrix so that it's the correct size, essentially you scale this matrix in some way, and then you make a local factorization of each element matrix. Okay. Then your final preconditioner is a product of the local factorization of each element matrix. So again, it has to be easy to solve mu equals r. So this is all just diagonal, lower triangular, diagonal, upper triangular solves. Okay. So the application of this is going to be relatively cheap in that sense. The question, of course, is how well this approximates the original matrix, so what good convergence properties does it have? Okay. And here's another idea along the same sort of lines, just in a slightly different way. This time the element matrices are really factorized themselves very locally. And if you number them here, you do need a special node numbering property. If you number them in a special way, you can again construct lower and diagonal. These are all symmetric problems, I should say. And you can construct very specialized preconditioners. So these are, I mean, this is literally the tip of the iceberg in terms of preconditioning, the different methods out there. Just to give you a very rough idea of some of the things you might do. The key thing to remember is you're always doing this balance between the cost of the preconditioner solve and the gain you're getting from the preconditioning method. Right, so to finish off then, I just wanted to mention some other things to bear in mind when you're writing your code or you're running your program. So first of all, some examples of stopping criteria. These are very standard tests that very often you might want to use to decide when your method has converged. With left preconditioning, remember this was a case where the preconditioned residuals are not the same as the original residuals, so you might want to unprecondition them in the stopping test. Okay, so rather than just looking at the size of the residual, you need to factor back in the preconditioner before you check your accuracy. Otherwise, you could get a skewed view, particularly if you're comparing different preconditioners. This is very important because you want to be comparing like with like, so you want to be comparing the true residuals. Okay. Some examples of, for example, condition number dependent stopping criteria. You might want to include the condition number of the coefficient matrix in some of these. Very often you're able to get good estimates of this, even if you don't know it. You could get good estimates on the way through if you're using a method, for example, that uses Langshoff's. Well, that was what it was designed for, to get estimates of these extreme eigenvalues. And these things can be picked out and incorporated into the algorithm on the way through. And my final example, although again these are just a random selection in a way, you might get stopping criteria based on backward error analysis. Particularly in PDE problems, more and more people are developing stopping criteria based on the actual PDE properties that are measuring things in the right norm for the PDE. Okay, so it's not just a simple case of using up here the two norm of the residuals less than epsilon. You might need to think through in your problem what's the appropriate stopping criteria for what I'm doing. So it's really just to flag that up as a bit of an issue. Right, so finally, as I say, we probably get to what's the most useful part of the talk, which is where to find all this stuff and where to find out more about these things. So first of all, in terms of software, it's very often not that economical to start writing your own codes for iterative methods these days. To be perfectly honest, there's a lot of extremely good codes out there. For example, in MATLAB, you've got PCG, BYCG, GMRES, QMR, all of these things are now one-line MATLAB commands. Right? Oh, to have had that when I was a PhD student, that would have made my life a lot easier. But unfortunately, it was not the case. But it's there now, so you know you can do that. You can do preconditioning in these things. It tells you in MATLAB, when you type help QMR, it tells you exactly how to implement all these things. There are many, many other software packages out there. A lot of them are collected on NetLib, so you can go to the web page or you can email them and ask them, send a list by anonymous FTP, collect all these things. These are just some very few examples that I just trawled through NetLib to find a few of these. These are the kind of original by the author, things like QMR pack and so on. I think a lot of these are the versions that are now in MATLAB, actually, these algorithms, but there are very many things out there. Sandia have a lot of codes. One thing I haven't said anything about is parallel processing, right? I'm just, do we have anyone talking about parallel things this week? Not really, but there's a wealth of, some of these are parallel algorithms. For example, here, MPI algorithms. That's a whole different ballgame, which we have here. The main thing is that there are some extremely good books on iterative methods out there, which is good news. The top one there, the templates book, has a lot of codes. You can get the codes from NetLib to go with that, and it writes down the algorithms in a way that makes them very easy to code up if you want to code them up yourself. the different books have probably different approaches and different sort of slants on the iterative methods. This one here is only just out by Henk van der Voorst, but a lot of them, well, all of them have very extensive reference lists as well. Okay, so from the slides and so on, you'll be able to go through and identify the chapters that they will give you more detail on the ideas. There's also some recent and not so recent summary papers which are extremely good on giving overviews on what's happening lately in the subject. There was a special volume of Journal of Computational and Applied Maths that had a lot of very good survey papers in, which is a very nice source again of references and summary, and there's historical papers on the subject as well, which is nice. And this one here was referred to, I think, in Henk's book, but I don't know if it has actually appeared or is to appear, whatever. I haven't seen that one myself, but he quotes this as being a good survey of preconditioning techniques. Okay, so...
It's available from Benzie's...
it's available from Michaela's website. Right, so Michaela's at Emory University, right? You can pick that up. Okay, so to summarise then, try to give you a very rough overview of symmetric positive definite, symmetric indefinite, and non-symmetric codes with this veritable alphabet soup of methods out there. The important thing is to be aware of what's around, I think. Don't just think you CG will solve all your problems and you can pick it off the shelf. But having said that, there are some very effective and very efficient methods available. There's lots of extremely good preconditioning techniques, so you'll find out a lot more about them in the rest of the week. That's the motto of the story. That's what you have to remember and take home with you. So I will stop there. Thank you.
Any questions? Comments?
Hi.
It's probably a question. MinRes was invented in 1975, and the GMRes came out in 1986. Why did it take 11 years?
I'm going to ask Jean this question. Why didn't you produce TMRes, Jean, in 1977?
Well, first of all, there was a predecessor to that by a man called Albert Delmar in the British Computer Journal, where he didn't take the generalized sequence. He took R0, R1, R2, and he actually did develop some GMRes like that. I think a lot of these things are a function of the computer architecture. So, you know, as things grew, it made a difference. So in the 50s, you know, you had 1,000 words of memory. That's why maybe the conjugate gradient method was less attractive and SOR was more attractive. Mm-hmm. But as things evolved and you got bigger memory, then methods come back. Mm-hmm. Which points out to a point that none of these methods, you know, are inscribed in stone. That is, as architectures and computer environments change, then new methods come back, old methods come back. For instance, the Jacobi method was developed in the 50s, and then it fell out of favor. Then with vector computers, it came back into fashion. So, you know, methods come and go. And I suspect GMRes was just considered as... The idea probably occurred to others, but it was just sounded like it would be too expensive. As I said, you know, Albert Delmar developed it for just a few vectors. That's all he probably felt he could use. Mm-hmm. But only when large memories became available did the general GMRes come.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would guess as well, although I don't know if this was the case, that this paper of Faber and Manteuffel that said you couldn't retain minimization and short-term recurrence came out in 84 or something, right? So I would imagine people had been trying to find methods that had both of these, and maybe that changed thinking because they showed that this couldn't be done, and maybe then people had to think different tacks. I don't know if that's right now.
Another class of matrices to put under that are non-symmetric, but are the matrices that are real positive. That is, when the symmetric part is positive definite of a non-symmetric matrix, and there are specialized three-term occurrence-like methods that do work. So that's
Right, yes, and also, I mean, I haven't mentioned anything about complex matrices or so on today as well. A lot of these methods you can apply to complex matrices in different situations. So I haven't covered that at all today. Okay. Is that us?
So that was really beautiful. Thank you so much, Alison. We really...
You're welcome.
Thanks.